The medical community figured out a few years ago that some of the best painkillers out there, the likes of OxyContin and Vicodin, are highly effective and highly addictive. And the efforts to reduce their use and abuse have produced their own side effects. Liam Moriarty from the JPR Newsroom looked into this recently. We'll vary from our usual format today to hear Liam's reports, and he'll be here to give us some additional perspective around each of the four reports. We'll take your questions and comments in the live portions. So here's report number one. Like many areas in the country, Southern Oregon is experiencing what public health officials describe as an epidemic of addiction to heroin and prescription opioid pain relievers, such as OxyContin. One symptom of this epidemic has been a sharp rise in deaths by overdose. JPR's Liam Moriarty looks at the problem through the eyes of people on the front lines. We begin with an overview.
The first thing I realized when I started reporting on the heroin epidemic in Southern Oregon is that pretty much everything I thought I knew about it was wrong. For one thing, unlike some places I've lived, I didn't see strung-out junkies hanging out on the street, so how much of a problem could it be? But Joshua Grainer, an addiction counselor in Ashland, told me most heroin addicts these days are not your stereotypical street junkie.
These are professionals. They could be in government, they could be in medicine, they could be in drug and alcohol treatments as professionals that are actually actively using heroin, and they're doing a really good job covering it up.
Grainer heads Colpia Counseling Services in Ashland. He says he can count on one hand the number of his clients who started out using heroin. So how do professional people come to be heroin addicts? Dr. Jim Shame says mostly it's their doctors who started them down the road to addiction.
We've created a couple of generations of people who have been dependent on opioids because their physicians and their nurse practitioners and their PAs believed that what they really needed were opiates for their pain.
Dr. Shames is the medical director for Jackson County Health and Human Services. He's leading the local effort to rebalance what he sees as a long-time overemphasis on prescribing opioid painkillers. Those synthetic drugs chemically resemble heroin, and they act on the brain in similar ways. And for many addicts, heroin proves cheaper and easier to get than prescription opioids. Daryl Inaba says doctors weren't alone in creating the addiction problem.
We're in a major growing opiate epidemic, and it's been initiated, I believe, almost by the pharmaceutical industry.
Inaba is director of clinical and behavioral health services at the Addiction Recovery Center, or ARC, in Medford. He holds a PhD in clinical pharmacy, and his book on how addiction affects the brain has become a widely used training text. He notes the pharmaceutical industry successfully lobbied federal regulators to increase the potency of their opioid pain relievers, using industry-funded studies to argue the higher doses would not lead to patients getting addicted. Those studies, he says, turned out to be wrong.
They've learned a long time ago, as major capitalistic industry has learned, addiction is money. If you got something that's addictive, people do whatever they can to get it.
The pharmaceutical industry has denied any intent to profit from addiction. Another assumption about heroin addiction I had to unlearn was a sense that it wasn't that big a problem. But according to the Centers for Disease Control, from 2010 to 2012, the death rate from heroin overdose doubled in a 28-state study area that included Oregon and Washington. Since 2009, more Americans die each year from drug overdose than from car accidents or guns. In Southern Oregon's Rogue Valley, there are 250,000 prescriptions written each year for opioid pain relievers. That's more than one prescription for every man, woman, and child in the valley. Living as I do in leafy, upscale Ashland, I assumed heroin addiction was likely focused in grittier parts of the area, like West Medford. Again, I was wrong.
It was very easy to get heroin in Ashland.
Diana Cooper is a 27-year-old mother of four and a recovering heroin addict. She started taking prescription opioids after a painful bout with meningitis when she was 18. She says the slide from prescription drugs to street drugs is ironically aided by attempts to rein in overprescription of opioid painkillers.
When your doctor says, you know, I'm not supposed to prescribe these anymore, and so this will be your last dose, you're going to panic. And you're going to find an illegal source. And once you've broken that barrier into illegal sources and illegal activity, there's really no cap on it.
So as access to prescription opioids tightens, addicts shift to cheaper, more available heroin. Liam Moriarty, JPR News.
And Liam joins us in the studio here on the Jefferson Exchange. This is your chance to get in questions and comments about the opioid painkiller issue in the society. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Liam, what was the genesis for the whole series? How'd you get started on this?
Well, back last winter, Jennifer Margulis, who's a very good freelance journalist, lives here in Ashland, and she does stories for the Jefferson Monthly, which is our JPR members magazine. And she was doing one on this topic, and I got wind of it, and I asked if I could tag along on some of her interviews, because I thought there was a chance to, you know, ride along on that. So a couple of these interviews I did with her, a couple more I did on my own, but she did... folks are, who are interested actually can go online, IJPR.org, and find her article. I think it was called Deadly Euphoria, about the whole thing. And she talked to some of the people I did, talked to some other people, and covered it in a somewhat different way. But that was sort of how I got involved in it.
I gather there were a few surprises along the way for you. I mean, the whole thing, as you just begin to peel back the edge, seems to certainly made my eyebrows go up as I've heard this over the years.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people have stereotypical images of hard drugs and users of hard drugs. Certainly, you know, I'm a baby boomer, so I've got my images set from, you know, coming of age late 60s and the 70s about what junkies are about. And it's a whole different animal now. It's a whole different animal now. And I just found, as I said, that many of the kind of preconceived notions I had going in about what I was going to find turned out were not the case at all.
The opioids have been out there for a while. Now, is the knowledge that they are addictive something that came later? I mean, it seems like this is the kind of thing that might have been caught in clinical trials.
Oh, they've known all along. I mean, these both oxycodone, which is what OxyContin was a brand name of, and Vicodin, which is a brand name for hydrocodone, those are both invented like right after the First World War, rather, both in Germany, by the way. And they've been marketed in the U.S. since the 30s, and they've known that they were addictive. I think basically the genesis, everything I've been told from the doctors and the therapists I've spoken to, and you'll hear some of this in the upcoming reports, was that during the 90s, there was a concerted effort by the pharmaceutical industry to promote these drugs as having new formulations that were not as addictive and were more effective and could be used, as long as they were used in the prescribed doses, could be used long term. And there was a raft of studies that were funded by the pharmaceutical industry that indicated this was okay. And this became sort of the orthodoxy in the medical profession. And there was also a big increase in what they called compassionate pain management. And docs were told, you don't want to leave people in pain. You want to, you know, help them out. And these are the drugs that'll do it. And we'll talk about more after the next piece. We'll kind of zero in on that. We can talk more about that then.
Okay, good setup. Liam Moriarty from JPR News is sitting in with us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're talking about his series of pieces giving the front row view of Southern Oregon's epidemic of heroin and opioid addiction. Next, we meet Dr. Jim Shames, an addiction specialist and the medical director for Jackson County Health and Human Services. He says doctors like him played a key role in creating the epidemic. Now he's leading innovative efforts to turn it around.
In the 1990s, Jim Shames was a family physician in private practice, and when patients came to him complaining of pain, like most other doctors, he'd often prescribe opioid painkillers such as OxyContin or Vicodin.
It made sense to everybody. It made sense to me. That's the way I was practicing in the 90s.
Shames says doctors were being pressured to provide more pain relief. Research papers, many funded by the pharmaceutical industry, contributed to a growing professional consensus that opioid painkillers were safe and should be used more liberally.
When your state medical board says, hey, docs, you really need to be more compassionate about treating pain, when you go to the hospital and they say, don't let people suffer with pain, otherwise we will look negatively upon your recertification, after a while, you've created an entire thought bubble that supports your point of view, and that's where we have been for a while.
Shames reached a turning point several years after he became medical director for Jackson County Health and Human Services. In 2006, he says, the county medical examiner brought to his attention a stunning fact.
Do you realize we have about one citizen a week dying from accidental overdoses in Jackson County? And I said, I cannot believe those numbers. I said, you're going to have to show that to me. And we sat down in his office and we pulled file after file after file of people who died from prescription drug overdoses.
Confronted with this grim toll, Shames started looking for ways to, as he put it, turn off the spigot on the opioid drugs that had become so ubiquitous. He formed the Opioid Prescribers Group and invited doctors and other healthcare professionals to develop new ways of treating their patients' pain that don't risk turning them into addicts. He says the existing treatment model simply doesn't work.
You walk in, we close the door, we spend 15 minutes, you expect a pill, I expect to give you a pill, and out you go, everybody's happy. This requires something very different.
Shames' group has devised guidelines for appropriate use of opioids based on research that suggests for most chronic non-cancer pain, opioids are not the best treatment. The group has also developed alternatives to opioids that involve a range of practitioners, from physical therapists and mental health counselors to acupuncturists and yoga teachers. Shames says this is a new approach for most doctors. But, he says,
whatever the modality is, whether it's way out there in terms of what a physician's comfortable with or something that really resonates in terms of the therapy they're used to, it's got to be coordinated. And that's where I think the difference is.
Shames says many doctors are getting on board with the new approach. Others, not so much. But he says the numbers show the effort is making a difference.
The most hard data you can look at is who lives and who dies. We had 46 accidental overdose deaths in 2006, and we're now down into the low teens or single digits.
But it turns out there's a perverse consequence of this success.
The more successful we are at reducing the number of pills being prescribed, the more expensive they become on the black market, and the price of heroin's just going down.
The result? What Shames calls a huge upswing in overdose deaths from heroin. The irony is not lost on him.
We've been concentrating initially on the upstream, which is, as I said, turning the spigot down. But there's a lot of downstream public health measures that we need to take as well.
Among those measures, Shames says, is making effective treatment available to those who got addicted by following their doctor's orders. He says he still carries that sense of responsibility.
I feel bad about it. I feel like I, in a sense, kind of pushed opiates on a number of people that would have been much better off without them.
Liam Moriarty, JPR News.
And Liam is our guest in the studio to talk about the series of reports he's done for JPR News here on the Jefferson Exchange. This is the part where you can get in your questions and comments live, 800-838-3760, around the region by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I underlined one of the things that Jim Shames said earlier in the piece, one citizen a week dying from overdoses to prescription drugs.
Yeah, in 2006. It was like 46 people in 2006.
That's a shocking number.
He was shocked.
He was, obviously. At that point, we've had him in here talking about the opioid prescribers group in the past.
Yeah.
Did he give you any sense of what the initial response was from the medical community when he began suggesting, let's put this group together and start talking about ways to reduce these prescriptions?
Yeah, he said, it was a mixed response, and it continues to be a mixed response. You know, there are other people who were sensing that, something's going on. They may not have had access to, the main line of information that he had because, where he's at, he kind of is in a position to see more. But there were folks who knew that this was not going the way it was supposed to go, and they were seeing some of the effects. There were others who thought the problem was being exaggerated and thought that the way things were going was pretty much okay. And over the last, I think the opioid prescribers group's only been going for like a year, year and a half, something like that. It hasn't been that long. I know that it's only fairly recently in the last year that they put together these guidelines, prescription guidelines, how much you ought to prescribe for what sorts of pain, and put together alternatives for pain management for people for whom these sort of drugs are not the most appropriate type of pain relief.
And what are the alternatives usually? I mean, it's generally doing less of anything, isn't it?
Well, I mean, this is where it gets to that kind of coordinated approach he talks about, and this multidisciplinary approach where you're bringing in not only you're using not just the pharmaceuticals. There are herbal things. There are exercise things. There are counseling things. There are sort of mental exercises that people can do that can help them manage their pain. I mean, he mentions back pain. Back pain is a big thing. Back pain's all over the place. And a lot of people have been given opioids for years for back pain. A lot of these addicts are people who started with back pain. He says, really, the best thing for back pain is to get moving. you know, is to exercise, is to stretch, is to, you know, and so you're bringing in physical therapists, you're bringing in yoga teachers, you're bringing in meditation teachers, you're bringing in this whole realm of ways of approaching the problem other than just, you know, trying to stimulate the opioid receptors in the brain so everything feels fine.
Did you get into at all the issue of insurance coverage for some people? Because I don't know if somebody's insurance plan might say, yeah, we'll cover you for the prescription drugs, but we're not going to cover you for the physical therapy and the yoga and whatever else.
This is becoming a thing, and apparently more, you know, the coordinated care organizations that are becoming a big part, especially in Oregon, of healthcare, that have been sort of insisting on a coordinated approach and new approaches to doing this because it costs less. It's been, you know, the state has been spending a whole lot less money on healthcare, say, for public employees because they've been using these coordinated care organizations to drive down the costs and make it more efficient. They've gotten on board. The Affordable Care Act has made it easier as well, I've been told by a number of people. And so, because I asked a number of folks, is this not really expensive? You've got all these different professionals in and everything else. And what Jim Shames told me is that, you know what's expensive? Surgery is expensive. You know, having addicts is expensive. This stuff is relatively not expensive. Much cheaper way of handling it in the long run.
All right. And do they set some benchmarks for success in reducing the opioid prescriptions?
Well, you know, it's hard to quantify a lot of this stuff. I mean, again, when I spoke to Jim Shames just last week before I wanted to check in and update and make sure that things were current, and he said he was just about to check in on some of the newest numbers. So they're not, they're not always – he said in a small area like this, you don't have access to the same sort of numbers as you do like national organizations and things like that. So it's kind of hard to quantify. Like he said, I mean, for me, the metric I'm using is that there are a lot fewer local people dying of overdoses these days.
Which is a good thing. JPR News, Leah Moriarty from JPR News is sitting in with us on the Jefferson Exchange this morning as we go through his series of reports of people with a front row view of Southern Oregon's epidemic of addiction to heroin and prescription painkillers. In this next segment, we meet Daryl Inaba. He's a doctor of clinical pharmacy and a co-author of Uppers, Downers, All-Arounders, a book on addiction and the brain that's widely used as a training text. He says while the belated recognition of prescription opioid addiction is cutting back on new addicts, not enough is being done to help the people already hooked.
Daryl Inaba understands the push for what's known in the medical field as compassionate pain management. But he says he realized some years ago that the movement to provide patients with adequate pain relief had backfired.
My God, doctors are overprescribing these things. They're addicting people. They're creating junkies out of law-abiding, decent people who now have to find their opiates on the street.
Inaba says a contributing factor was the pharmaceutical industry's successful effort to persuade federal regulators to allow opioid drugs such as OxyContin and Vicodin to be made in doses many times stronger. For example, he says,
we have Vicodin, hydrocodone, which is classically only 5 milligrams, and now it's 80 milligrams and 120, so there was a whole promotion that these can be safely used and not addicted.
It didn't turn out that way. During the 2000s, communities across the U.S. saw spiraling rates of addiction to prescription painkillers and of deaths from overdose of those drugs. Between 2000 and 2012, nearly 4,200 Oregonians died from overdoses. And while OD deaths peaked several years ago, the death rate in 2012 was still four times higher than at the beginning of the decade. Daryl Inaba says natural opiates, such as heroin and their synthetic opioid cousins, are so powerfully addictive because they mimic the body's own pain-killing and stress-fighting chemicals.
And when they do so, your brain mistakes that it has enough balance of those chemicals, and it turns off its own chemicals.
When that happens, Inaba says,
your brain becomes imbalanced in chemicals so that you need to keep taking the opiates just to function as a human being.
Over the past several years, efforts to dry up that flood of pills have led to fewer people dying from prescription drug overdoses. Most doctors aren't writing prescriptions as freely, and insurance companies are limiting how long they'll pay for them. But making it harder to obtain these legal opioids hasn't helped the patients who are already addicted, and they often turn to heroin, which can be easier to get and cheaper than prescription pain pills. And while overdose deaths from opioid painkillers have started to decline, heroin ODs continue to rise. Inaba says efforts to fight the opioid addiction epidemic haven't translated into enough support for treatment programs such as the ARC in Medford, where Inaba is director of clinical and behavioral health services.
At the Addictions Recovery Center, we had 3 or 4 months waiting list to get into residential treatment, and a lot of the men on that waiting list are suffering from horrendous opiate addiction. And that what that means is many are going to die before they get in. Many are going to get incarcerated before they get in, and many are just going to give up and continue to use.
Inaba says it's time to rethink a common social judgment that says addicts are weak-willed, losers who cause their own problems and don't deserve public help.
Society needs to realize that it's not a matter of choice for these people, that it's a matter of their biology.
He says creating more opportunities for addicts to get help is not only the compassionate thing to do, it makes economic sense, too.
It costs us, what, maybe $40,000, $50,000 a year to keep somebody in jail. We gave that person $5,000 worth of outpatient treatment. We get much better outcomes, and they fare much better, and society fares much better, and there's less criminal recidivism.
For Inaba, the bottom line is that addicts aren't some anonymous other whose suffering we can ignore.
They're your children. They're your spouse. They're your doctor. They're your minister. They're your judge. Addiction crosses all lines because of its biology, not because of what the choices are.
Liam Moriarty, JPR News.
And Liam is our guest in the studio to do a debriefing on these pieces of reports about what's going on with opioid painkillers and the addiction to them, and where it's driving people in some cases to heroin. We're inviting you to join us as well during these live segments with your questions and comments. 800-838-3760 by phone on the Jefferson Exchange. Email jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email from Jay in Walterville. He says, I am a victim of anti-opioid hysteria, the modern temperance league. I nearly was killed by a car while on my bicycle. Surgeries and rods and screws in my back, extreme arthritis. This is the kind of overkill that caused alcohol and marijuana prohibition. On Oregon Health Plan and Medicare, you cannot get physical therapy and a realm of alternatives. Jay writes, this is politics, the DEA again. So what is left for the chronic pain sufferer beyond opioids? I mean, if we're trying to get people off of them, Liam, what's the general thrust of where they send people?
Well, I mean, where it's going locally, where Dr. Shames and the Opioid Prescribers Group have been going is pushing, like I said, this multimodal approach to, you know, and I'm not sure I'm quite understanding what Jay is saying there, because the information I've got is that a lot of this stuff is available to bring in these other non-drug related ways.
Should be available under OHP and the like. Okay. Much more to talk about with, we have one piece left to talk about with Liam Moriarty of JPR News, back on the Jefferson Exchange with him and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. It's 8:36, and you're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're in the midst of a discussion with Liam Moriarty from JPR News, our reporter, our resident reporter. He's been working on a series of reports about addictions to opioid painkillers and the fact that since there's now a crackdown in progress on the prescription drugs, that it's sending people in search of cheaper street drugs like heroin. It's a really interesting series of reports. You can contribute your comments and questions to 800-838-3760 by phone around the region or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Barry in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thank you.
What's on your mind?
I had hip replacement surgery and was given oxycodone. One thing the doctor told me is that OxyContin was more addictive than oxycodone. And my understanding is that OxyContin, there's a higher concentration, greater amount of the medication in the pill. It's supposed to be slow release, but people get in trouble by chewing it, and then they release it all at once and get a lot more of the drug than if they just swallowed it.
Okay, let's see if that's in the realm of Liam's expertise. Thanks for that, Barry. Appreciate it. What'd you find out about
it? Yeah, sure. I mean, OxyContin is essentially a brand name for oxycodone. Oxycodone is the generic drug. OxyContin is a brand name. I think Purdue Pharmaceuticals is the one who has mass-produced it. They have made OxyContin in stronger doses. It used to be like 5-10 milligrams. Now they're making them 80 and 20. And they have, as Barry had said, they've been making them in these they've been trying to make formulations that are harder to abuse. So they've been making things that, like, you can't crush up and snort, because they've, like, put a nasal irritant in it so that if you snort it, you don't get high. It just makes your nose all funky. Or things that'll gel if you try to crush it up and make it into something you can inject, you know. But the time-release thing he talked about, again, it's a formulation that in your stomach will release over time, as opposed to, you know, but if you try to chew it up to get it all at once, it doesn't work for some reason. I mean, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has worked real hard to come up with these formulations that can't be abused. What Daryl Inaba told me about that, he said it takes the people on the street about a week to figure out how to get around it.
All right. While we're talking about Daryl Inaba, because he's the addiction expert, Susan Notown Given writes in, subject line, benzodiazepines. She says, Valium and drugs like them are also widely prescribed and are also extremely addictive. I'm adding the word also. No one in the medical community seems to know much about it or how to get off without going through terrible withdrawals. There are receptors in your brain for these too. Please address this as part of your discussion. Thanks. Did Valium and the benzodiazepines come up in your discussion with Dr. Inaba?
Not really. Through the course of this, they haven't come up. I mean, she's right in that they do have an analogous pharmacological effect, and there are issues with that as well. But the folks I spoke to all zeroed in on the opioid, so that's sort of where I went with it.
All right, so let me get into the final piece here, because Liam Moriarty is introducing us to several people with a front row view of Southern Oregon's epidemic of heroin and opioid addiction. In the final part of the series, we meet 27-year-old Diana Cooper. She's a mother of four from Medford and a recovering heroin addict.
Diana Cooper says probably the scariest moment in her addiction was the night she was driving with her four kids along the Oregon coast, headed toward Gold Beach.
And I had a lot of cocaine, but I didn't have any heroin. And so I was nodding out while I was driving. I kept doing more cocaine, thinking that would keep me awake, and I just kept nodding out. And I woke up hitting the guardrail on the other side where the cliff is to the ocean.
Cooper says her 8-year-old daughter Ada still talks about the time mommy wrecked the green van. Cooper started taking prescription opioid painkillers after getting meningitis when she was 18. She had ongoing migraines and was kept on opioid drugs such as Vicodin and Percocet for the next 7 years.
After a while, I realized that I did not like to function without taking my medication.
Cooper says she eventually needed the pills just to feel normal.
And you don't even realize that that's what keeps you normal. You know, that's what keeps you functioning.
When she was pregnant with her fourth child, her doctors kept her on the painkillers, but on lower doses. So she supplemented her prescriptions with pills from the street. Her son was born prematurely with a low birth weight. But Cooper says her doctors didn't seem concerned. At the time, she wasn't either.
Now, I can't even look at his baby pictures when he was first born. He didn't look normal. He was very gray, he had dark eyes, you know, he was very skinny, and I could tell. Now I can tell.
Cooper's life spiraled downward. For a while, she was homeless. She, her husband, also an addict, and the kids lived for several months in their van in a Walmart parking lot. Then, shortly after her youngest was born, Cooper tried heroin. She liked it. A lot.
Your heart is racing, you get a rush, you get a lot of endorphins, you feel invincible to the point where I can do everything I need to do, nothing's going to hold me back, no little pain, no illness, no nothing.
From then on, heroin was her drug of choice. Soon, though, Diana's husband Matt had enough. He insisted they both get treatment, and reluctantly she agreed. Cooper and her family got into a residential treatment facility where they could all be together. She says at first, all she could think about was getting a fix. But she knew if she left, she'd lose custody of her children.
That really says something to the pull of addiction when you're considering, do I stay here and get clean, or do I leave them all here and I go use? You know, when you're even contemplating that, I love my kids, and I would die for my kids, but at the time I wouldn't give up heroin for my kids.
On her third day in treatment, Cooper met a recovering addict who told how her newborn baby had been taken from her for several days when she entered treatment.
And she said that the day that they gave her her baby back, the want to use immediately was lifted. And as soon as she said that, mine was lifted. I realized I didn't have to want to use.
Cooper and her husband have been clean for about 2 years now. Both are working, and she's going to school to study early childhood education. She wants to be a clinical social worker. She still struggles with her addiction, and she says it's her day-by-day discipline to keep her dealings honest and above board.
I have to keep myself in check about everything. I can't lie for people. I have to be totally upfront and honest about everything in my life. Or else, yes, I will go back out.
Cooper is grateful for the help and support she and her family have been given to get their lives back on track. She urges people to get educated about the addiction problem and get involved in solutions, because she says addiction isn't something that happens just to other people's families. Liam Moriarty, JPR News.
And Liam's in the studio with us to discuss the series of reports. Well done all around, Liam. And
thank you.
How'd you find Diana?
It was Jennifer who found Diana.
Jennifer Margulies?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. That was one of the interviews where Jennifer had set up, and I tagged along and recorded. And I got a few questions in there, but that's basically where it came when Jennifer was working on her piece for the Jefferson Monthly.
So there's a law enforcement angle that hasn't been discussed here, and I wonder what, if anything, you were able to find out from police about how they're approaching the situation where you've got people who are no longer able to get prescriptions for things like OxyContin and Vicodin and instead are turning to heroin.
Right. Well, I did actually have a conversation with Lieutenant Kevin Walriff. He's a lieutenant with the Medford Police Department, and he's the commander of what they're calling the Medford Area Drug and Gang Enforcement Team, which MADGE, it has the acronym. And It's one of these federally designated high-intensity drug trafficking areas, and Jackson County is one of nine counties in Oregon that are designated as one of these, you know, high-intensity drug trafficking areas. Basically, I-5 is a, you know, there's a lot of drugs that come up and down I-5, and mostly they come up, you know, a lot of the heroin comes up from Mexico. Meth is a huge issue for them. Walriff said, you know, when he was – When they started this a number of years ago, meth was the big thing, and it was all about meth. And he's found just in the last few years, heroin is really making a big comeback. And he was saying 2007, they confiscated 2.5 grams of heroin, and that was just in Medford.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, the MADGE team seized almost 12.5 pounds.
Yeah, it's a bit of a difference.
Yeah, a bit of a difference. Yeah. So he says meth was far and away our biggest threat. Now heroin is right on its tail.
Okay. Well, we'll probably be hearing more about this down the road. If you would like to hear more from Liam Moriarty, his reports air all the time on the music services of JPR. You're going to hear more on the News and Information Service, and all this stuff is available on our website as well. Liam, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.